Hey, welcome to Stuck at Ohm. And today I have the great privilege of talking to Professor Jeffrey Sachs from Columbia University. I have read him for a very long time. I have been educated by many of his thinkings, and he is a true globalist. So, Professor, thank you for making time and coming on my dinky little podcast.
Hey, Ohm, it's great to be with you. Please call me Jeff if you would. I would appreciate that.
Right. And also congratulations on the newest addition to your growing family. You have a granddaughter now.
Well, I have four granddaughters, actually. So, yeah, this is a good business. But a new one arrived and I dedicated it to her. Exactly, the new book.
That is amazing. And the new book is called The Ages of Globalization. And I can't help but notice the irony of the timing of that book. Whether it's the coronavirus or whether it is our political environment, it seems globalization is kind of out of fashion these days, or at least seems to be going out of fashion. I wonder if you have some thoughts about that.
Well, globalization's not going away, and the fact that here we are zooming with each other is the core reason we are interconnected. We are instantaneously interconnected around the world. The world economy has trillions of dollars of payments and clearance every day. The number of terabytes that are circling the globe is unimaginable and rapidly expanding. And throughout human history, this is the point of the book, there has been an arrow of greater and greater globalization, because fundamentally globalization is driven by technology of communications and transportation. That's not going away. The digital age will be intensely global. Maybe we won't move from our offices or from our homes and we'll work from home, but I guarantee you we're going to work globally when we do so. Because we're going to be interconnected as we have been throughout human history, and even more so now.
I think the thing which I wanted to ask you was about, in the past, you know, the physical geography has been, or physical location has been a very key part of globalization. And so, you know, if technology and the network and communicating online is key part of the next phase of globalization, you know, what happens to the physical presence? Like, what is the role of physical location in the next phase of globalization?
It's really an interesting and hard question, because the main facts of globalization are that we started, of course, as foragers, as hunter-gatherers. After the start of the second phase or second age of globalization, the Neolithic, we became more and more farmers, and throughout human history, almost all human beings were farmers. Starting with industrialization 2 centuries ago, more and more of the population shifted from subsistence farming to industry and then to services. Now we're largely a service economy in the high-income world, 80% or so of employment in services. And it's generally been true that services have depended on face-to-face. So we moved into cities as technology mechanized agriculture and raised productivity of agriculture. People went to do non-agricultural things, and those were almost invariably better done in the cities, even industry, but especially services. So we became overwhelmingly urban in the high-income world, 80% plus. The world as a whole is estimated to be 55, maybe now 60% urban. And there has been no evidence of a change of trend. But now comes COVID, and one thing is clearly changing. Our office culture and production in offices will not be the same after this. I'm sure you're having the experience, but I'm having the experience every single day of a conversation saying, we're not going back to the office after this. And we learn that we can do 80% of our work. That's even true for goods producing industries, but especially for services. We can do it from home. We can do it from anywhere. I had a conversation about my own team, which organization that I direct for the United Nations, the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, the staff, of course, working from home and wants to continue working from home. So I raise this because this is really the first time I've said to myself, maybe the densely settled city isn't so inevitable as I might have thought, because I've lectured for decades saying we will continue to urbanize. That's a one direction arrow. And now it really is true that we can be more decentralized in our activity. That was true even before COVID, but maybe we're recognizing it a bit more. All those office buildings in Midtown New York, what's going to happen to them? Definitely there's going to be a huge, huge downscaling of on-location work. Now, what will that mean for where people live and how they live? In principle, it means people could spread out more. I've talked to a lot of commuters typically we're spending, although it's unbelievable for me, but it's not so unusual, an hour and a half every day in each direction. So maybe 3 hours of commuting to get to a Midtown office in New York. And now they're saying, yes, we're going to be working from home and saving 3 hours a day of commuting time. So I think the answer is cities will remain, but that directionality of high dense population centers probably will be beaten back a bit by technology fundamentally and by the experience that we're going through right now.
So in many ways, I guess the hyperscale city, the idea of a hyperscale city is now probably relegated to emerging economies because they don't have a choice. Countries like India, Brazil, parts of Africa, they get the hyperdense cities because they can't really afford to do what the more evolved like economies have been able to do so far.
You know, I live in a hyperdense city in Manhattan, and I like it a lot. I don't have a car, which is absolutely wonderful. I get to walk to work. I get to walk to the United Nations. There's everything all around. So I rather like it as a quality of life choice. During this period, I've been with family in a more remote area, enjoying the woods and the wilderness a little bit more than I'm used to. And I can see the attraction of that as well. But my guess is that the cities still offer, if they're well designed, they still offer quality of life and productivity that is worth it and is not going away. The problem with the hyperdense cities, say Delhi or Mumbai or Rio or Sao Paulo, is, of course, they're not just densely settled, but they're highly polluted. People on the worst end of the income distribution are breathing foul air, drinking foul water, having very difficult lives. And so if we are going to have cities, they ought to at least be clean, decent places to live. And this is a core proposition anyway, even before COVID, but my God, we should take a note to build environments that are safe for people. We also know that this virus is killing people in more polluted areas. The air pollutants, especially PM2.5, which Asia lives under day by day, is absolutely a comorbidity or risk factor for serious coronavirus disease and death, because it creates lung disease, and that is the vulnerable point for this virus. So I think these megacities needed a lot of change to begin with, and I believe that moving to a digital economy can provide a lot of that, because I'm a believer in electric vehicles. I'm a believer in at least shared transport, including public transport. I'm a believer in not having to have one car per person as the definition of economic development. It just seems so antiquated and something from the last century, not from what we need right now. And having this horrendous air pollution really is a mass killer. It kills more people than COVID does. It's estimated it's 5 to 10 million excess deaths a year from air pollution in the major cities. And last time I was in Delhi, I could not see. I was in a hotel room that was just absolutely not quite the middle of the night, but it was broad, not daylight, it was broad daytime, but dark out and horrible. And that went on for several days. And nobody should live like that because it's absolutely a killer. Also very depressing in my experience, and solvable by getting out of coal and into sunshine, wind power, and so forth. And so that's what we should be doing anyway.
Right. Now, when we talk about our current state of affairs, whether it's the all the talk about anti-globalization, all this, and then, you know, we've had 4 or 5 months of essentially economic shutdown. Historically, have we experienced something like that in the past? And like, how have we dealt with situations like this in throughout history?
Well, of course, we've experienced pandemics before, and they have been enormously destructive and costly of human lives. This is the worst of these pandemics in 100 years since the flu of 1918. I dealt a lot in my career with the AIDS pandemic and with the malaria and tuberculosis, which are mass killers and hugely disruptive of lives and society. So in this sense, you know, we've been here before. And of course, the bubonic plague and the many, many waves of plague used to just be a normal part of life in Europe and in parts of Asia. So yes, in this sense, this is a part of the human experience, a bit shocking to experience and to live through. Certainly, we don't recall, I don't have any analogy in my own life of this deliberate shutdown of public spaces and much economic activity. I don't know really of anything comparable to deliberately closing down a world economy within a few weeks. Between the beginning of March and mid-April, we shut down almost every part of the world deliberately. And so that's something very unusual, and it doesn't fit any of the normal economics. The question of how to respond to this is very evident, which is that shutdowns are stupid if you can do the better thing, which is decent public health management, which unfortunately the United States has been incapable of because of our weird government, which is incapable of everything. But we shouldn't have to go through exactly what we're going through. And the East Asian countries, the Asia Pacific countries, to be more precise, have just done much better than what we have experienced in the United States. China had an epidemic outbreak, of course, it's where it started, but then it got it under control within 60 days. Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Vietnam, Australia, New Zealand never had this kind of mass outbreak because they took note from the beginning. And one of the things, by the way, that's just interesting, they went to face masks just at the beginning because good hygiene and be safe. And it stopped a massive amount of the pandemic right from the beginning. So part of what we ought to figure out in the United States is how did we become so unruly? And so incapable. Of course, Trump is, in my opinion, the most incapable, unpleasant person ever to come anywhere close to power in the United States. Cheney, okay, that's maybe another another case for me, but Trump's the worst president ever, and it has affected our whole country. 110,000 deaths, social unrest, mass unemployment, because everything's been handled wrong. So I guess my answer to the question is there are parts of this that are part of our human history. There are parts of this that are unprecedented in our lifetime. And there are parts of this, I don't know if I'm allowed to say it on your show, but that are just a shit show, because we should not be having anything like what we're having right now. But that comes from the total failure of a federal government that's supposed to do something instead of the foolishness that it actually does.
So from that standpoint, let's talk about it. Like, I think, you know, in many ways, this has been an unprecedented event. I cannot comprehend the impact of it, you know, from an economic standpoint. And yes, socially, we're starting to see its impact. You know, that's like the sheer number of, you know, people who will, you know, slide into poverty is pretty clear. Like, you know, no one wants to talk about it, but that's it's what's going to happen. And it's going to happen to people who, you know, the country has largely ignored for the longest time. They're not part of the top, you know, 10, 20% of the society. And so in a sense, I mean, I personally cannot comprehend the real scope of what we are going through, you know, from an economic standpoint. Like, and, you know, and yet we have a stock market which is already predicting a better future and already predicting great times ahead. So, and I'm just trying to figure out how to read this. I would love to get your opinion on this, given that you deal with facts and figures more than I do. And I do.
Well, let me start with the weirdness of the stock market, which is, you know, up 10 to 15%, say S&P 500 over a year ago. And if you had asked me a year ago, okay, here's what's going to happen, Jeff. We're going to have a loss of 20 million jobs. We're going to have an output decline quarterly rate 25-30%. We're going to be closing down a lot of the economy. Give me your prediction of the stock market. I guarantee you I would not have said up 10 to 15%. It's unimaginable. So what is happening? You know, partly the Fed's pumping out trillions of dollars of credit. Partly there are greatly inflated expectations of an imminent vaccine, which is very doubtful to me that it's really imminent. There's lots of irrational exuberance, but there's another thing that's going on, which of course is that the stock market is not even in its best moments a snapshot of the economy. It's a snapshot of a piece of the economy. And S&P 500 is half now basically tech. It doesn't represent the small shops, the services, the retail outlets, the restaurants, the office workers, the gig workers. They're not part of S&P 500. And it's not just that the tech side is booming. It is really cannibalizing a lot of the rest of the economy also, in the sense that Amazon's success is not only that it's an efficient, quite remarkably so, e-commerce entity, it's actually gobbling up the brick and mortar sector at an accelerated rate because of the pandemic. So I think what we're seeing in the stock market is not really a measure of the overall economy. It's a measure of one piece of the economy and the exclusion of the losing side of the economy, which is by the weights of the companies in the index, literally not recorded, reported, or given anywhere near the human or even the economic weight, say, that brick and mortar retail has in the GDP accounts. It just doesn't have it in the stock market. So what we're seeing in the stock market, in short, it's not all healthy. It's not, oh, isn't it great? We've got a recovery coming. It is rather a big shift of national income towards a narrower part of society. Of course, the most dramatic single factoid of that is that Bezos's net worth is up $35 billion since January 1. By the way, that's a lot, even if it were not just 6 months. You know, $35 billion, yeah, one person in the middle of this collapse. And so that's a shift, not a record of, all of the great things coming from this crisis. But it does mean that we're also seeing this dramatic acceleration of what we've been talking about for years, which is that the digital economy produces incredible services. I'm a big fan, but it surely has an incredible adverse effect on millions of jobs. So I think most of the jobs being lost, maybe not, who knows, half of the jobs being lost, say 10 million of these jobs, that's 4% of employment in the United States. I'm sorry, it's 6% of employment in the United States would be not returning, because they really reflect a greatly accelerated digitalization of the economy, not simply the downward part of the V-shaped bounce back after this is over. So I'm a bit of a pessimist on the job side, and that means that all the questions of inequality, all the people that are were doing work that was low paid, difficult, not so pleasant work, now don't even have jobs, and those jobs are unlikely to return. So it's a huge social question.
So, you know, again, picking this cue from your book, you know, you say the physical geography, you say technology, and then you talk about human institutions. Let me go back to the early days of Industrial Revolution. The economic disparity during that time and the living conditions and the exploitation of the workers led to two classes of, two schools of thought on economy. One was the more capitalistic thought of, thought process, and then what became essentially the socialist or the Marxist approach. And they both came out of Manchester. It was not like, it was a direct outcome of the workers and their conditions. Do you think that, A, that we are at the end of the industrialization phase of human history, is finally the pandemic kind of drove the final nail into the coffin? And if that is indeed the case, are we at the cusp of thinking about new human institutions of organizing economy and thought processes around economic output?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the early Industrial Revolution is so fascinating for all of these reasons, but it's been the great debate in economic history for decades. You know, did living standards go up or did they go down in the early phase of the Industrial Revolution? I think the steam engine was the single most transformative invention in history, perhaps up to what the transistor is going to mean for our age. But the steam engine changed everything, created an industrial world that was simply impossible before it. And led to what in the data is the start of rapid economic growth. And yet, that's the same world that Engels wrote conditions of the working of the labor class in 1844, saying how there had been a decline to misery of people working in the factories. And I think the history at this point, having sorted out all of this, is that indeed, there was a rise of national income, but a decline of wage income for a significant part of the population in the first three or four decades of the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. That gave rise to the Communist Manifesto, to Marx and Engels, and to the belief that it would always be further immiserizing of the working class. And that was the thesis of Marxism. It turned out by maybe the 1870s or 1880s, there was clearly a more general lift of wages. So actually what was experienced in the first decades clearly reversed, so that labor income as a share of national income began to rise, wages began to rise along with productivity. And then by the time I got to studying economics, which was, I'm sorry to tell you, 48 years ago when I started the study of economics, I was taught that there was almost an iron law of the other direction, which is that if productivity increases, it lifts everybody. My favorite president of my lifetime, John F. Kennedy, made a famous statement that a rising tide lifts all boats. That's what I was taught in economics, that the labor share of income was a constant. And so if national income rose, the labor share of income would rise right alongside it. This is not true. And actually, starting around 1980, productivity began to continued to rise in the U.S., but wages became stagnant again. So we saw a divergence. And mechanically, you can also describe that as a decline of the labor share of national income, which has been going down quite a bit. What's the explanation of that? National income has gone more and more towards capital income or towards intellectual property, which is sometimes counted also as a kind of capital income. And if you're, you know, high school diploma worker in the service sector, you haven't really seen a real wage increase for 40 years as, you know, as a typical worker. So now digitization could be like that early phase of the Industrial Revolution again, making a big positive contribution to overall productivity, but being felt extremely unevenly. You know, the ultimate vision of this is that Bezos owns everything and none of the rest of us has any job because, you know, there's just one giant set of warehouses. They don't even have workers in them because they're all robotized. So it's all robotic warehousing and it's self-driving vehicles and it's e-commerce and, you know, you can imagine the disappearance of vast swaths of jobs in the economy. And that's a logical possibility. It's not an economic illiteracy. That's a real possibility that most everything that we want done in the economic sphere can be done by smart machines, AI, and so on. I'm actually a believer in that. What does it mean for humanity? It means one of two things. The dystopic vision is that we're all impoverished except for Mr. Bezos and Mr. Zuckerberg and a few others. Or the utopian vision, it means, we all have our leisure time. We all have good living standards. We all sit with my favorite beverage, coffee, and are sitting at coffee shops each day and so forth. That's actually not unrealistic. Also, it's what Keynes wrote about, John Maynard Keynes, in 1930, when he said in a fantastic essay called The Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, he said our biggest issue in the future will be how to handle our leisure time, when we won't need the kind of mania of having to work for a living because productivity will have gone up so much. So that's the long answer. The short answer to your question is we're definitely in a new age. We're definitely in the digital age. We've been already in it for a while, but the pandemic has accelerated changes that would have taken years to take days or weeks. So we've been thrust dramatically into the post-office world, into the e-commerce world, into the e-governance world. We're not going back. But we're going to need new institutions to handle that. One institution that's critical throughout history is government. And I think the digital world should fundamentally change government. The reason we have representative government is that you could not have all of society hanging out in Washington, D.C. but it's perfectly possible to have all of us hang out in a national Zoom meeting and deliberate on issues in ways that we didn't do before. So I think that there's a real chance to change what participation means, to change what democratization means, to change what deliberation means. And I think we really need to do this seriously. Of course, there are a thousand complicating issues. I don't want to oversimplify it. A lot of smart people are thinking about this. But I do think the digital age will also create digital governance, not just in the delivery of services, but in allowing for people to participate in a more meaningful way in their lives. One of our problems in the United States is that Congress became wholly owned by vested interests. And so Congress is uninteresting for us, generally speaking, because it doesn't represent the American people. It represents the campaign funders. And that has been a breakdown. So I've been interested for a while in why aren't we doing a crowdsourced legislation? Why aren't we participating in a more creative way where people can have their say or listen to experts, not just have Congress put in legislation in the middle of the night that was written by some lobbyist. So these are changes that I think are really possible for our time. And the technology always has changed the institutions. If you had writing, if you had printing presses, if you had broadcasting, you have a different kind of governance. Now we have digital, and we should have a digital governance that is empowered by these new technologies.
So one of the things, you know, you were talking about this. I think one of the theories which have been, you know, talked about is like we will have a lot of leisure time. There will be this thing called the universal basic income. And, you know, there is good arguments on each side. But I always go back to this idea of, what is a man's worth and, you know, a woman's worth? It's like what we do also helps, gives us texture. It gives us, you know, it makes us who we really are. And especially in the American way of thinking, our work is what defines us more or less. And I think if anything, the post-80s meltdown of the American manufacturing sector has been the erosion of the American, you know, psyche in many ways, because most of us identify with the work we do. And so going forward, like, you know, there is all these great ideas which are put forward, but they don't take into account what will we do with our free time. I mean, are we going to all become part of some troll army as many of the young people are becoming now? Are we going to become like, you know, activists? Or like, what are we going to do with that free time? Because most people aren't really that creative. Most people aren't really that, you know. I mean, 80%, 20% rule applies to everything, even creative.
You know, I'm a big fan in general of Northern Europe, of Scandinavia, and of the ideology of social democracy. So I consider myself a social democrat. And social democracy emphasizes broad social inclusion, not 100% equality, but universal access to the goods of life. And in a social democracy, that includes, obviously, universal access to healthcare, universal access to good education, universal access to family leave, universal access to paid sick leave, and so on. One of the things it also includes is universal access to paid long vacation time. So it's pretty typical in Northern Europe that you're guaranteed 4 to 6 weeks of vacation time as just part of your human side. It goes with every job. And also the work hours are considerably less. So in the United States, we work, I think, an average of about 1,700 hours a year now. In Korea, it's still 2,000 hours a year. In Germany, in Sweden, Norway, Denmark, it's closer to 1,300 to 1,400 hours a year. So let's say 300 hours a year less. And with 40-hour work weeks, you're talking about many weeks of work difference. In these countries. Are they unhappy? No, frankly, they like their vacations, by the way. They like their shorter work weeks. They express a higher level of happiness in the annual report that I helped to co-edit called the World Happiness Report, which reports a Gallup survey done each year asking people about the quality of their lives. So there's actually good empirical, practical evidence from outside the United States that we could be working less and enjoying it more and sharing it a lot better. And where does the meaning come from? It comes from other things. It comes from, first, leisure time, nothing wrong with that. And in classic Western Greek thinking, that was the highest time for contemplation, for the arts, for the enjoyment of the finer things in life. So that's all good. I think a lot of people would appreciate the chance for lifelong learning, for new opportunities to do things. I don't think the meaning that you expressed, and I'm very much like that. My family would kill me if I claim not to love work because I am a workaholic. But I enjoy the work out of the substance deeply because I find it interesting and fascinating to work on these things. But also I like the learning that comes along with it in various fields. And I think a lot of people would like the chance for gaining other kinds of skills, for more time. So I think we'll find meaningful ways to occupy ourselves. That was Keynes's question, by the way. What will we do with our time? In the United States, we never face Keynes's question because we have been working very hard and we're so unequal that poor people work much harder. Of course, it's the trope of richer people that poor people are lazy, and it's not only false, it's just profoundly nasty because poor people work a lot harder in physical labor, in unpleasant conditions, in dangerous conditions. They're keeping the whole economy going right now in the United States, while people who have work that they can do at home are safe. And not putting their lives at risk. It's poor people who are out every day cleaning or delivering or on the front lines or helping in hospitals. This is where the real life of our economy is right now, but our reward system in the market is really twisted. So one of the worst ideas in social thought came a bit from Calvin, from Protestant doctrine, is that your human worth is measured by your market return. This is such a bizarre idea to begin with, and such a bizarre idea that you should live on what the market gives you as opposed to what society as a whole deems to be right for the members of the society. So we have a lot of twisted ideas that actually go back to the 16th century and just our kind of messed up thoughts that we carry around in the Protestant ethic and so on, which isn't really about human dignity. It's just bad ideas that, well, God favors you if you're making a lot of money and disfavors you if you're not. And that was a bad idea of Calvinists a long time ago. It's an outmoded idea, but it is actually part of the American cultural ethos and not a good part of it.
We've also changed, you know, like in from the early 1900s, the, you know, how to value labor is like, you know, it's essentially some labor is deemed less, you know, valuable versus some is more. So I think the inequality in our society is a lot of these ideas we are holding on to from the industrial and pre-industrial times. So I'm going to switch fast forward because I know I'm running tight on my time. I want to understand how you view the next phase of globalization. And I want to focus on the opportunities of that globalization. There is too much negativity out there. I want to like get some of the uplifting aspects of the future.
Well, good, because there is a lot of possibility. And I think a good starting point is technology is possibility. It's not reality, and every technology has its downside possibilities as well as its upsides. So one should not be purely techno-optimist or a believer. I'm not in the camp of Steven Pinker that the world just gets better and better no matter what, that there's an inevitability to it. History has too many U-turns and terrible disasters, and human nature has its very dark side that makes very bad things possible. So I don't want to say I'm making a prediction, but I do want to say I'm making a possibility. So in our digital age, the digital technologies make possible, much more than in the past, a world of prosperity. 15 years ago, I wrote a book called The End of Poverty, where I said we could end poverty. I'm afraid that the current crisis could set this back, but not really inevitably. It's notable, a bit poignant, that this was the year that China ended its poverty, which was nearly universal poverty 40 years ago, and they got extreme poverty down to zero in China. And I take that as an indication of what's possible. So I'm a big fan that digital can make e-payments. It can bring people into education. It can bring remote areas to telemedicine. It can create jobs, as we've been talking about, from on long distances. It can dramatically lower the costs of doing business and so on. So while there are downsides to the technology for poor countries that used to make their way by cutting and sewing apparel, and now robots do that, that's true. That's a negative. But on the other hand, the potential upsides of these technologies for decent jobs and decent lives, I think, is much more powerful. The other point that I would make is on this universality, it means that the world doesn't have to be divided as it has been since the Industrial Revolution between the rich world and the big poor world. We should be aiming for a world of convergence where living standards are converging everywhere. And that is already a gradual trend that's been underway for decades, but it really could be accelerated dramatically. So I'm not a fan of America first. I'm not a fan of any country first. I'm not a fan of America running the world, not that it even tries anymore. And I'm not a fan of China or anyone else running the world for that matter. I'm a believer that we could have a global convergence where the benefits of science and technology are widely shared, that we could move to much safer physical technologies, especially renewable energy, as we were talking about, out of the fossil fuel age. And I think that this pandemic should accelerate that transformation. And I'm just hoping and everywhere preaching, as it were, global cooperation to get this done. I'm a bit aghast at the most recent attempts of the United States to further isolate or to try to isolate China, which is both naive, nasty, and unimaginable in my view. But, you know, the U.S. wants to make cold wars. I wouldn't say the U.S. I would say certain nationalist policymakers want to make a new cold war. This is both dangerous and completely misguided. So for me, the upside is we could have better lives, safer planet, and global cooperation. How about that for optimism?
I mean, before you go, there is one question I have, which is about, you know, like one of the key themes of your book has been ability to communicate. Like communication is very key part of globalization. And each phase of globalization has seen the ability to communicate become faster. And now we are at blitz fast, you know, phase where diplomacy and politics is now a tweet, you know, at least from our president. And the Chinese and the Iranians and everybody else is actually using that and, you know, becoming, it's becoming a game of showmanship. So the communication methodology of today and tomorrow, which is the network, to me, that is something that it probably is the dark cloud on this phase of globalization than anybody anything else. Because I feel that, you know, we don't get enough time to pause, think, contemplate, and actually develop some kind of trust on information and institutions. So I don't know what you think. And after that, we can wrap it up. This is fascinating.
Yeah. I recently went back to read some of Marshall McLuhan, who, of course, was the media guru. His whole thesis was in the Gutenberg galaxy that the printing press had changed everything about how we think, how we act, how we learn, how we communicate, how politics is organized, and that the mass media were doing the same thing. And he talked about the global village in that famous work as a kind of terror chamber. He called so much right 50 years ago, actually almost 60 years ago now, in the medium being the message, that even foreseeing how this echo chamber would be a kind of terrifying echo chamber. I think there are two points that are really weird. Of course, the signal to noise ratio is collapsing in an age where the mass transmission of bytes is so inexpensive. There's so much garbage, it's hard to know what's real. And so the fake news phenomenon is a very serious problem of signal to noise ratio, and we haven't solved it. The tweeting is really something astounding. I loved Twitter for a while. I liked having followers. I liked counting them. I liked seeing the immediate response. And then at one point, I got completely trolled when I was trying to defend China from attacks, and I quit Twitter. And I'm so happy that I did, because it was, for me, an incredible distraction that I understood in retrospect better than in the context of using Twitter. But now, from outside Twitter, I cannot believe we make politics this way. It's crazy. And it's not only our crazy president who's out of his mind, as far as I'm concerned, and that's with or without Twitter, but to respond to Trump on Twitter is also crazy. Can we have a real conversation, not your tweet versus this tweet? And then when I wake up and I try to read the news online in the morning, and the stories are about the Twitter feed following this tweet and who said what and so on. This is, I'm sorry to say it, maybe it's my age, but this is not meaningful communication right now. It really is so detrimental to our well-being. And we have become so stupid as a society in ability to face a problem right now. We can't solve anything in America adequately. We can't solve basic public health. So that's why we have 110,000 deaths. We can't solve climate change, because not only the vested interests, the stupidity, we just cannot solve it. We can't solve gun violence. We are unable as a society to solve anything right now. And of course, the best documentary of our political plight, the absolute serious study of this, is the movie Idiocracy from 15 years ago, which showed what it would be like when society really reaches the complete idiocy that it can't figure out not to put Gatorade on the crops, and that this is why everyone's hungry. And that's where we are in America right now. We got stupid as a social problem solver. Lots of smart people, but our systems are stupid in that they cannot process information, deliberate socially and reach rational outcomes right now. And this is amazing. Now, why is it? It's probably all interconnected with things we've talked about. But one point that I think is very important to understand is that a lot of the dumbing down of politics is not only, say, Trump as a demagogue trying to use the medium, to reach his followers, but the dumbing down was a deliberate, methodical action of corporate interests that wanted to make politics stupid to stop regulation. Why did, for example, Newt Gingrich, one of our worst politicians in modern history, close the Office of Technology Assessment of the U.S. Congress? Here was a systematic body providing information and data to Congress about new technologies, but it was giving messages that this technology needs regulation, this one may not be environmentally safe, and so on. So Gingrich closed the office. And when I recently spoke to one of our best senators in the U.S. Senate, and I complained about how idiotic the discussion is on public health, he emphasized to me, said, "Jeff, you have to understand, this is part of the strategy of deregulating environmentally hazardous industries. We have systematically eliminated all of the rational thinking processes in politics for the sake of powerful interests." So this is what I would say. The medium has its own dangers, but it's also being used by powerful interests in deliberate ways to make our conversation stupid, to make us respond viscerally rather than rationally and thoughtfully. And I'm, by profession and scholarship, a follower of Aristotle, whose whole theory of politics was building both the virtues of the citizenry and the rational capacities of the citizenry and of the state. And we became irrational, Trump Exhibit A. But we need to put deliberation and the pursuit of serious knowledge and problem solving back into the core of our politics.
Thank you, sir. This has been quite an enjoyable conversation, and I could go on forever.
It's great topics we're talking about, so fun to discuss them with you.
Hopefully next time I get to meet you in person and in New York City, my favorite city, and it will be lively and not a bore.
Sounds great. Excellent. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.